as well as other resident physicians. This podcast is directed towards PGY1s and medical students to give a brief overview of medical topics. This podcast is intended for medical professionals and is not intended to be used for medical advice. We are going to continue our series on shock, and we're going to go down the pathway of distributed shock and down a little bit further to septic shock. So with septic shock, Tark, we always talk about the presentation, and the presentation is relatively similar to general shock. But like, just again, recap as much as you can, or what's unique to some of the presentation symptoms, vital signs, etc.
Septic shock. Sometimes you're gonna have fever most of the time if they're in septic shock, but don't like harp on just having fever. They're gonna have tachycardia, hypotension. Sometimes they're going to have altered mental status. Depending on where your source of infection is, they might have abdominal pain, they might have flank pain, depending on your source. There's no set findings for these patients. They're tachycardic, febrile, altered. They have warm extremities because this is part of your distributive shock.
At least initially, they have warm.
So you're thinking, or this is septic. They have wide valve pressure, low systolic, low diastolic, but diastolic is lower compared to your systolic.
The other thing I guess I would mention with febrile, because some people think, oh, febrile, septic shock, there you go. But if they don't have a fever, also keep in mind, low temperatures can also be considered in this category as well. So not always high, can be also low.
They sometimes don't have to be tachycardic. They might be bradycardic, normal heart rate, because they're going into irreversible stages of shock. So you have to think of how everything together.
I'm purposely avoiding the definition right now. We will try to circle back, because definition, I think, has a lot to do with the labs and whatnot, because I think you get this big old workup. You decide that it's septic shock. You can plug the labs in and they will tell you what stage, sepsis 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera. And maybe not 4. I'm not sure 4 even exists, but I'm avoiding the definition at this moment. We will try to circle back to that a little bit, because it does help with the management. But as far as the workup, a lot of this is, again, going to be related to where the source of your infection is. If you know where it's at, then great, you can go that direction. But at least in the initial workup on these patients, what kind of things are you grabbing?
So you're going to have a broad workup initially. You're getting a CMP, a CBC, a lactate. You can get Procal, CRP, it's not necessary for treatment. It's just something to see, oh, they have severe sepsis. I'm putting them on antibiotics. I want to see their response. Most of them are going to get a chest x-ray because most of them are altered. You can't really say, oh, they don't have a chest infection or something, but it's not necessary in your treatment, but everyone gets a chest x-ray. And then you think about what's causing this. So depending on what's causing your sepsis or septic shock, then you go down the lane. Oh, I want to do a CT scan of their head, CT scan of their chest, because I'm thinking they have a brain abscess, they have mucormycosis, they have lung abscess, empyema, they have severe pneumonia. Then I'm doing a CT chest to figure out what's causing them to be in septic shock, because that's like a late presentation of just infection. Oh, I'm thinking they have something intra-abdominal abscess, peritonitis, or they have liver abscess, severe cholecystitis, perforation, whatever. Then I'm going to do a CT abdomen. I'm essentially want to look at the liver. I want to do an ultrasound. It's like you're going to.
I think this is the first time you've almost pan scanned the patient.
Yeah, you're going to tailor. Because ultrasound, you can do ultrasound, look, but it's still not going to give you that picture you're going to paint.
And then I think along with this, procalcitonin, plus or minus, I think, honestly, you're right, it can be used later on for de-escalating some of your antibiotics. I think there's some literature out there that kind of suggests in the first 24 hours, at least on ED presentation, procalcitonin can be low.
It's delayed. So you have to think it's delayed. Their procal is negative at first because it's a range. It's not, this number is positive, this number is negative. It's a range of numbers. You look at less than 0.5, then they're less likely to have an infection. They will say less likely. It's not a negative number because they might have come in an early presentation. They just started having fevers. Then you have a negative procalcitonin. You're not going to say, oh, they have negative procal. I'm not going to put them on antibiotics. That doesn't work.
And then with these patients, obviously the physical exam, the history taking is going to be paramount. If they've had a recent surgery, hardware placed, lines placed, ports, you want to check all those things out. This patient's bed bound, or they're complaining of maybe some pain in their groin. If they're altered and they're not complaining, you don't have a source, you should start looking for things like necrotizing fasciitis. It's never necessarily top of our list as medical professionals to check out the groin area of our patients, but this might be one of those situations where doing that could pay off with finding that crash, and that will lead you down a pathway where you can emergently ask your friendly general surgeon to come in at 2 o'clock in the morning to operate on this patient, but that could save that patient's life, as opposed to finding out maybe 24 hours later when the patient finally gets to the unit and the nurse does a full skin exam and says, hey, this doesn't look right. Now you've missed a little bit of your window to intervene on a patient. So if you're not finding an immediate source that explains why this patient's febrile, they're in this shock state, try to expand out and look for all different things that could be helping to explain. Also, look at the medication history as well, because sometimes there's mimics of septic shock, which we'll get into a little bit later. And then, of course, if you're thinking meningitis, then go ahead and try to get an LP on these patients. As an intern, as a medical student, might be a little bit rarer. Your ED residents might have already beat you to that. Other things they throw into the mix is some coags, looking for platelets, fibrinogen, PTINR. This source I was looking at mentions D-dimer. I think in the year of post-COVID, the D-dimer is a dangerous lab to order.
Yeah, everyone gets a D-dimer if you're thinking PE. Don't, if you're thinking PE just with the CTA,
yeah,
D-dimer is going
to
be high.
Your D-dimer is there just to justify it. You want to get that CTA.
Yeah.
You just, this is a completely aside from septic shock, but you want to get that CTA. You just want a D-dimer to tell you that it's okay to do it. So we initiated their treatment, or at least a workup. There's a few different mainstays of treating septic shock. Obviously, the treating the underlying cause, so the infection. So we have the antibiotics, we have the resuscitation, we have keeping the MAP above 65, ideally, and then that
map.
Protecting the MAP, yes. So then that for that, we have our pressors, and we have fluids, which is going to be a more relatively controversial thing. But at least in the initial workup, I know there's some guidelines that Tarek wants to talk about.
The problem with fluid resuscitation is that you have to think about, it's not a shoe that fits all, right? You have to individualize how much fluid each patient gets. I know Surviving Sepsis campaign says 30 mL per kg's ideal body weight. You have to remember it's ideal, it's not total body weight. It's like you have a 300-pound patient and you're just going to give them 9 liters of fluid, because that's what the guidelines say. It's everything is taken into consideration, like heart failure. This is their ideal body weight. You want to reach euvolemic state. That's your goal. So previously, like, you go read the guidelines. Surviving Sepsis says 30 mL per kg in the first 90 minutes. So you have to be in that window of 90 minutes. That's where the benefit was seen. That's where the mortality benefit was seen. That's where everything, 90 minutes. Then the emergency medicine team said, no, your guys are saying 30 mL per kg for everyone. That's not how it works. And yeah, we have seen complication. And that's true, because if you give everyone 30 mL with a patient that has an EF of 10%, or they're having right heart failure, they have pulmonary hypertension, without knowing what's going on behind this, you see mortality. You're going to see complication.
We're going to start a multifactorial shock. We have a septic shock, we have a cardiogenic shock.
Yeah, it's hard because, like, I've seen patients that have septic shock, they have right-sided heart failure, and they get the 30 mL per kg, and nobody says it's ideal, it's not total, and they give them 4 liters, and their RV just gives up, and you have a whole other complication.
This is the guideline. This is the CMS. Every hospital EED is going to say 30 milliliters per kg bolus. You get a lactate, you initiate antibiotics within 90 minutes, and then you reassess 3 hours.
3 hours.
And then you either repeat that, you start pressors. This is the series of steps I think most hospitals follow. I'm going to throw just a little bit of controversy into the mix. I know this is generally an educational thing. My take is that septic shock is a maldistribution. Blood to different organ systems is a maldistributed hallmark of low diastolic pressure. So you have very poor vascular resistance, leaky capillaries.
Leaky vessels.
And so the idea that just throwing fluid at these patients is going to somehow improve the blood pressure is, I think, dubious a little bit. It's definitely something that it can show improved mortality after hospitalization compared to more liberal uses of fluid. At least 30 milliliters per kilogram tends to show reasonable good results, but fluid doesn't always equate to good perfusion. And the other thing I want to, I guess, bring up to this is that oxygen delivery to tissue is another issue that we're dealing with organ malperfusion. These organs aren't getting perfused very good. What they need is oxygen. And so what you're doing is you're giving this crystalloid, let's say you're giving a liter. Well, your body has about six liters of blood in. So you give another liter, you've just diluted your blood hemoglobin content by 1/6. You do that again, and you do that again. So your hemoglobin is going down. So the oxygen delivery to tissue equation is like a constant times cardiac output times hemoglobin times O2 saturation. So if your O2 saturation is good, cardiac output, maybe it improves with some fluid. Your constant, of course, is constant, but your hemoglobin now is going down because you diluted it. Your oxygen delivery is also not particularly great either. So I'm not saying don't give the fluid, but just think about it.
Everything has to be in balance, because too much fluid, I think it was in a trauma patients that have to do resuscitation, you're resuscitating them with fluid, but that puts them at a higher risk of DIC. And that's why we're later on going to talk about this in hemorrhagic shock and everything. You think about giving fluids, how much is too much and how little is too little. This is enough for everyone. That there's nothing like that, okay? You have to balance everything depending on your patient, their volume size. You have to follow up, repeat, do an ultrasound, get your IVC, get your volume status, check it. Their IVCs still collapse, or they start having to have B lines in their lungs. My fluid is not staying, so maybe I should give them protein. There's a lot of different stuff to think about before deciding. I'm just going to keep bolusing these patients a liter at a time and see. When you start reaching that 5 liters, maybe start thinking, this is not working for this patient. Maybe it needs suppressors.
Maybe your intensivist should be. And sometimes, depending on the way you're at, your intensivist may want to see that you've given it the old college try on the fluids. But just try to keep that in the back of your mind. We're going to shift to the sepsis criterias and the definitions, which I think will help guide maybe when you do reach out to. Let's go ahead and shift into that. So you got the SOFAs.
Yeah, so based on what I read, the most recent sepsis criteria, sepsis 3.0, talks about sepsis not just by their tachycardia, because every billing system is depending on the SIRS criteria. They have three of the above: tachycardia, tachypnea, altered mental status, fever, hypothermia, leukocytosis, leukopenia. That's essentially what SIRS criteria is. Has SIRS criteria showed benefit in diagnosing or early management of these patients? I don't think so. I haven't read anything. Eric can correct me if I'm wrong. But the last guidelines I've read is sepsis 3.0 definition is like sepsis is equal to end organ damage. And the way to look at end organ damage is to do the SOFA score for these patients. And they don't just say do SOFA score on admission. It's like it's a constant revision of that SOFA score to say they're having end organ damage, their SOFA score is more than 2. So they have sepsis with a likely source. Then you remeasure everything. You remeasure it in 48 hours to see, oh, their SOFA score is dropping down by 2. Then I'm going in the right direction. So antibiotics is working. Your volume is okay. Their oxygen is okay. They're not having any more end organ damage, essentially. No, their SOFA score is going up. Then I'm doing something wrong. This gives you an idea. I need to look at everything again. They're having end organ damage for some reason. Am I giving them too much fluid? They went into pulmonary edema, and that's why their oxygen is low. Their MAP is low. Do I need them to be on pressors? Do I need to call the ICU? It's giving you that leeway to think about reaching out to other specialties, to think about revising your management.
And so this is where you get like the sepsis 2 and the sepsis 3 criteria there. So you can look at MD Calc. They have the QSOFA score, which is a little bit more of a reduced amount of data you have to input, whereas the SOFA score has a lot more data you can input. And again, it's also, if you're practicing for a little while, you can see how some of these lab values change and they correlate to the clinical picture and direction of the patient. So it's just a nice way of quantifying it. I think it's relatively validated. And so then that's a nice little thing you can again go to your friendly intensivist and say, hey, I've been doing this at X, Y, and Z. They're not getting better. It looks like they're getting worse. I feel like they might need some pressure support. They might need intensive care. They might need escalation of care. And you get more specialists on board if you need them. It's another score, and it helps with your definition as well. Now we've covered definition. So I guess the next level, I'm going to go, since we were talking about protecting the map Let's go ahead and stay on that course for a second. We'll get to the real foundation of this, which is antibiotics, but let's go ahead and continue with pressors. Mm-hmm. We've talked about these in the past on the cardiogenic, but obviously now we're on a kind of a different shock. So we need to think about pressor support and what that means for our patients. What's your go-to or what kind of ones can you go for?
Sepsis is equal to levofed.
He's a levofed guy.
Yeah, because you have to think about what's the main thing that's causing your patients to go into septic shock. Their SVR is gone because they're vasodilated everywhere. So the first thing that's going to help with this is your levofed. They compared, I think there was a trial comparing levofed to adrenaline because they both help with SVR. They found that levofed had a better outcome. So levofed is your go-to. It changed a lot. Previously, levofed was the last line because you're putting this patient on levofed after trying epis. When you're putting them on dobutamine because their cardiac output is gone and you still haven't gotten anywhere. So it's the fourth. Now it changed.
I've read other literature, other resources that levofed tends to be the mainstay. We can get into dosing of levofed because I think dosing we've talked about in the past is dosing of levofed does change from inotropic to pressor. There's also other studies that kind of do suggest that vasopressin could be first line as well. And there's like the VANISH trial, I think, that mentions that vasopressin is okay.
Vasopressin, it's still playing on the same idea that I need something to increase my SVR, essentially. You're getting good outcome with the levofed because it has some inotropic effect. That's how I think about it. If your patient is tachycardic and you're afraid that they're still going to go into more tachyarrhythmia, you can think about vaso, but mostly you're having that tachycardia because you're having hypo. That's how I think about it. I try and go levofed first, see how they do. If I'm escalating too fast, think about adding something else.
Are you starting on the low dose levo? Or are you going to move? Are you moving towards the medium or higher doses?
I'm moving towards the medium. I like staying in the medium dose. I don't like going high dose because on a high dose, you're going to have
extra chronotrophy on top of the thing.
You're going to have the tachycardia. You're going to have limb ischemia because you're affecting the capillary perfusion. You're going to have severe ischemia up to the dry gangrene. I've seen that happen before. Starting at a low dose, I'm escalating. Then I'm starting to go at a medium dose. I'm thinking about adding something else to help me. I'm not going to keep bumping up that levofed. That's the only one I have. No, you have a lot of other medications to help along. You have the vaso, you have the epi. We can add steroids.
You have phenylephrine as well.
Yeah, phenylephrine. You have a lot of other options.
I think CAT trial indicates that epinephrine can also be considered. I think it was non-inferior to the norepinephrine.
It's not inferior, but...
And there was a resource I was reading about how if you were pressing the patient, you're working on getting the blood pressure up, and you, let's say you're on norepinephrine, you're on vasopressin, and you maybe check on the heart, and the heart's just not squeezing quite the way you want. This is going a little bit back to the cardiogenic side of things. Epinephrine can be really great for that inotropic support at low doses.
So you have to remember that some of these patients are not going to be isolated. Because in severe sepsis, you have end organ damage. Heart is one of the organs, so you might have myocardial ischemia, you might have stunning of the myocardium, you might have tachycardia on top of everything. So it's not, I'm going to try this, and this is what the guidelines, I don't think I've read anyone that say you go through norepi first, that fails, you add this, you do this. I don't think I've seen anything like that.
And again, this goes back to the art of medicine. You add things on, you can start taking things off. Sometimes you're on high dose norepinephrine, you're on vasopressin and phenylephrine, you can go down on the levofed and find that it has no difference in the, like you've half the levofed and you're still having the same benefits. So just, it's an art, a little bit of art. There are medications, there are pressors that you want to avoid. Which ones?
You have the dirty dope.
Yeah, dopamine. We're going to hate on dopamine a lot.
Yeah.
There's really no good indication for it.
There's no indication for dopamine in any. I've never seen it used. The only time I've seen it used, if it's bradycardia induced, and not a lot of people use it anymore, I'm just going to do epi. Let's not go down that pathway. Don't use dopamine.
The other one I think is interesting, dobutamine, I think some people do use. I find it interesting because it has a vasodilatory effect, and that can be problematic with a patient who already has vasodilation.
It's not on its own. Like, I don't think I've ever used dobutamine on its own for sepsis, for septic shock. He can use it as an add-on, like thinking he has a mixed picture of cardiogenic and septic shock. So I want to get good cardiac output and I want to titrate that SVR to a point that it's within normal. It's not too high, too low. So I always think of it as an add-on or a mixed picture that I use it.
Fair enough. And then, so I guess the general takeaway here on the press is LevoFed is probably going to be your go-to. Everyone, no one's going to fault you for starting LevoFed. You can do vasopressin, you can do epinephrine. You can start adding things on as you need things, as the blood pressure is allowing or does not allow. And then just keep in mind taking things off as you don't need them.
Yeah.
Let's go to the final pillar of our septic shock antibiotics. I think I'm going to keep this relatively general because there's so many bugs that can cause septic shock. We can't go into each and every one of them. But in a general sense, patients coming out of the ED, what would you start them on?
I want to cover everything, right? You want to cover your gram-positive, gram-negative, and your MRSA. Essentially, I'm going to put them on vancomycin to cover that. Then I'm thinking I want to cover everything else. Then I put in mind, do they have kidney infection or not? So let's say they don't have kidney infection. I'm not going to just going to put them on zosyn and vancomycin because you're going to see a lot of kidney damage with that. I want to cover pseudomonas. I have the option of doing cefepime. It's going to give me almost the same coverage as zosyn. I'm thinking I want to cover anaerobics. I might add flagyl on top of it, but I think most of us just do cefepime and vancomycin or zosyn vancomycin and see how they get out of that first 24 hours, 48 hours and decide how to escalate or de-escalate. If I have a patient that has already history of ESBL, like extended resistance, I'm going to guide my therapy pending that I'm going to, say meropenem from the get-go.
Yeah. You can start with meropenem if you think of nosocomial infection. Cefepime does have a little bit of CNS penetration, so it can be better in that regard. I have also seen some literature now that says cefepime seems to prolong hospital delirium in older populations.
Yeah, if you're thinking more older history of seizures, you want to stay about away from the cephalosporins. Because they tend to have more delirium, more seizure activity. So you tend to get away from them. But still, in that first 48 hours, everything is open for you. You try whatever you think is going to benefit the patient, pending their previous cultures.
And then if you're thinking maybe a MRSA, you had the vancomycin for coverage, and you're thinking maybe a pneumonia, get that MRSA PCR swab. Get it negative, and you can probably de-escalate that vancomycin. You can progression de-escalate your antibiotics as you figure out your blood culture results and as you figure out what kind of bug exactly you're dealing with. Other kind of add-ons here, if you're thinking community-acquired pneumonia, you can throw on azithromycin or doxycycline for atypical coverage. Tick-borne illnesses, we're not really in the tick area here, but you have your doxycycline still as an option for that. P. diff. If you're thinking C. diff, oral vinc.
For dexamethasone, if you're thinking that they have previous resistance or they've had C. diff before and they didn't tolerate or didn't benefit from vancomycin.
And then I don't know how much evidence is for this one. One of my resources just talked about if you're thinking about toxin suppression of using clindamycin, and then with that one, just that clinda goes first, give clinda first and then give your other stuff. I haven't done a whole lot of research on that. I know that's
a lot of infectious disease people think about adding clindamycin just for the toxins. I've seen a lot of them say, it doesn't really show benefit. Just treat the infection, treat everything. But if you're thinking this is gas forming, you want to cover everything. So just throw the clinda on and see what else is going on.
And then finally, this is the pillar. I think this is the biggest pillar, obviously. If someone is sick, has a bacterial infection, clearing that is going to be paramount. It's going to clear the way for the patient getting better. The depressors can keep someone alive. Fluids can, I guess, keep the blood pressure up a little bit. But in the end, you're going to want that
source control.
Source control, those bacteria. So source control is going to be key. So these patients have lines. Think about getting rid of them. If they have ports that might be infected, maybe it's
time to take them out.
Time to take them out, depending on your bacteria. Talk to your ID doctor, talk to your specialists. If that's something that needs to happen, they add hardware like a hip replacement and they have a pretty severely infected incision site. Got to talk to your orthodocs and see, does that infection seed into the prosthesis? Endocarditis, you got to look into all these different things. Blood cultures, follow those up. they have bacteremia, treat with the antibiotics, retake your blood culture, see if you're actually making progress. But source control is going to be important. If you have abdominal abscesses and stuff like that, talk to your surgeons and see about draining those. Even IR drainage might be something that could be offered, because if you don't have source control, you may not actually end up ever clearing this infection. I would say just the pearls and pitfalls here, there are some mimics of sepsis. Like, they're not true sepsis, but they might make you think of sepsis. Under the endocrine header, you got your adrenal crisis, you have your thyroid storm, your DKAs. Sometimes they look like sepsis, but they're not. So don't be totally fooled. Just be aware of some of that stuff. There are some of your labs that can lead you down different pathways. And also consider, like in DKA, you can have sepsis and DKA. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Sepsis present as DKA. They don't have the other symptoms. Yeah, they just have the DKA.
And then other things like pancreatitis can make some people have the nausea, vomiting, some hypotension. Just be aware of that. You can get some lipase, get a CT scan of the abdomen. Fulminant liver failure can sometimes mask itself as kind of sepsis-like. Bowel obstructions, acute mesenteric ischemia can also present a little bit like sepsis. You have your PJP. Pneumonia, and then endocarditis can be sepsis, true sepsis, or if you have valvular dysfunctions, it can be more shocky and not necessarily sepsis. So just there's a little bit of a difference there. It's not very clear.
As we said, it's like you have to look at everything and make sure you don't miss anything. You have to think about each and every organ. The way I think about it, these shocky patients, you have to examine them from head to toe, look at their medications, think about everything that might cause them to have this. It's not just, oh, they might have bacteremia, they might have this. It's like looking at everything together, making a full picture of what you have, what you don't have, what you're missing to make this work.
All right. Is there anything else? This is a pretty big topic. We spent a little bit of time on it, but anything else we need to hit on?
The only thing is steroids. Think about them when you're having less of a response to vasopressins. You can try and add a steroid because you have adrenal insufficiency in most of these patients. Happen along when they're having septic shocks. Their adrenal is
extra credit if you know the dose.
200 to 300 milligrams per 24 hours, every 24 hours.
Is it the hydrocortisone?
Hydrocortisone.
Oh, okay. I've heard of like Decrodon, 6 milligrams.
For sepsis, I've always heard hydrocortisone is okay to go to because it has both mineral and glucocorticoid effect. So DEXA is more glucocorticoid. You're going to use it more in your ARDS patients, your COVID patients, because it's more glucocorticoid. You can add amindral corticoid to it. If you're thinking this is sepsis, this is septic shock, go ahead and do the hydrocortisone at a high dose and see how they respond.
All right. So we will be back with other parts of distributed shock in the future. This is just a big one. I think we're already at 35 minutes, so we will see how we go. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the podcast, I Am Basics. I want to thank the residents who took part in this show. It could not have been done without them. We hope you enjoyed this production, and if you did, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts. If you especially found it useful, share us with your friends and colleagues.